Dr. Koontz, I figured I'd just start us off with some fighting words for everybody to get into as we take on a pretty challenging topic. And I'll just put it on the floor. I personally believe that processed sugars, modernized grains, and talking images are more detrimental to the human condition than beer, coffee, pot, or a whole number of other things that people think are really bad while they continue to absorb these other things and not notice what's happening to their bodies. That may not be exactly where you want to go today, but it'll get us started.
How do you measure more detrimental? Because I think the thing that is a fighting word about that is not just the normalcy of the first class of things that you named. Although, you know, coffee is pretty sacrosanct as a widely consumed, you know, thing that affects you. But it's also that when you're talking about more detrimental, I mean, I guess I'm wondering what's the more, how am I measuring the detriment that's being done through processed sugar versus legalized marijuana?
Yeah. So the way I would answer that is evident physical activities or changes that are happening to the person, right? And the society as a whole. We can't measure that with marijuana as much as we can with sugar, but I'm going to suggest that sugar has done more to the physical capacity of the average human being to subsist than pot's ever going to do.
The growth, I mean, I think there's also a difference here, and you did say processed, is that you're talking about a difference between things that are nutritional in some way. You know, sugars are going to be a component of necessary biological processes to one degree or another, depending on, you know, what source you're getting them from. Are you getting them from honey? Are you getting them from wherever? But versus something that, I mean, I guess I want to draw a harder distinction maybe between food and drugs, in the sense that you'll notice that pretty much every society is going to have some kind of overlap between the two of them. Sometimes the word for drugs will have some relationship just etymologically to the word for food or the word for drink. So it goes into you and it changes you. But I think when you're talking about processed sugars, or when you're talking about the way that our, let's say, food system or food delivery system, you know, all the way from the plant that puts all kinds of strange things together into an impossible burger that's now going to be delivered to you cold via DoorDash. I'm not really sure you can call that food by the end, right? That if your food is so altered, so drastically different from what it was maybe even 20 years ago, let alone 40 years ago. And, you know, just go find random B-roll footage of any city in the United States 40 years ago. You will notice you could even, if you wanted to, get a 2-for-1 and go look at B-roll footage of September 11th, 2001 in Manhattan, and most of the bodies are unrecognizable. Today you would be like, oh, that guy must work out a lot. No, that guy probably believes he's overweight. So when there's no longer such a difference between, you know, food and drink consumed in some form recognizable to nature in the way that it gets to you, then I'm fine with having less of a distinction between food and drugs, because it seems like almost everything is becoming a drug. It's a highly altered substance sold to me at my detriment and for someone else's profit.
Well, even as someone who's trying to eat cow mostly, like I have to choose between cow that's raised with what it's supposed to eat and cow that's raised with what it's not supposed to eat. And what it's not supposed to eat is more genetically engineered than what it's supposed to eat. And that actually gets to me too. So like at the end of the day, right, bad medicine, I like that word medicine. I don't like it just because it has the Americana flair, but it seems to capture something of the challenge that we're talking about, that food in many ways has become poison to us. And we don't have a way to even think or talk about these things. And most of what I observe is sort of a shrug. Oh, well, I guess this is what it is. And I just don't think that's the virtuous way to approach repentance as a civilization. And then, so if we're going to talk about what goes into a man, right, that can potentially make him unclean, you know, are there such things? How do we define that? And a world where we're seeing a lot of things come out of people, and I would completely concur that most of these substances in any abusive use of them are going to bring out the worst of you, right? That's kind of the problem. Any what, lust, covetousness, greed, the edge that pursues passion for its own sake is going to bring out the worst of you. How do we have a civilized culture discussion about nutrition without people getting religious on you? That's what I'd like to know.
I don't really think we were ready for this one at all, because particularly our own, not just our own church, but our own theological tradition has been outstanding at defining itself by what it doesn't do. So unlike the Baptists, who are all hypocrites, you know, we can drink beer. Unlike the Mormons, who are crazy and weird and too nice and legalistic, we can drink coffee, you know, unlike. And the problem there is that doesn't give you a lot of positive direction for what you're doing in your own life. So if we can go back to this framework of seven deadly sins that we were using a few weeks ago, when you think about the concept of gluttony, that's a good place to start, I think. It doesn't exactly answer the question of drugs, both in their scheduled and unscheduled forms. So the widespread use of the even more widespread use of pharmaceuticals than of things that we talk about as being, you know, this defines a person as a drug user.
Insert the insanity of it all? Like, how much cortisone do people put on their kids? Have you ever watched someone like put cortisone on their kids because they think the kid needs cortisone? Have you ever read the fine print on cortisone? Goodness gracious. Like, drugs. It's just, we're so arbitrary in what we decide we're going to say is evil. And there are many, many things that are destroying us that we're not confronting. And again, you're going on this already, right? And gluttony, or the passions, is the place where we're going to see ourselves rise up to defend the evil, right? When it gets close to us. And so anyway, continue on.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think we're arbitrary about like drugs versus in the sense of pharmaceuticals or over-the-counter medication versus harder substances or something like that. I don't think it's totally arbitrary. I think it's human beings behaving in a way that they always have under different influences than they've previously had. And the way that they always behave is that if something is normalized, then they truly don't think anything about it.
Right.
Right. And if it's not normalized, then they do consider it, and they can consider it a moral issue, and they can especially give it moral reprehension that if it's normal, they don't. And I don't think that's arbitrary. I think that is a result of the widespread use of, for instance, over-the-counter pain medications or, you know, relief medications for various problems, which, mm-hmm. you know, may or may not be more prevalent than they were in the past, or they're certainly different than they were in the past when most people's pain was of a, you know, slowly accumulating lifelong nature, because most people's existence is, you know, historically full of just backbreaking work. That's life, and your body breaks down rapidly after a certain age. Whereas now I think we are able to preserve ourselves longer, and then we slam into old age in a way that probably people were driving a little more slowly into it, even if it was in some ways more painful. But they're not, for instance, you know, if I say, well, oh, you have a problem with your throat. Have you tried boiling the bark of a slippery elm, the inner bark of a slippery elm? You know, well, what is a slippery elm?
Right.
You know, that's not normal. So normal would be that I'm going to try to knock this out with Sudafed, or I'm going to knock myself out with NyQuil until I'm better. And, you know, and I'm just going to, and because that's normal, nobody's really thinking about, I consume the substance and it just makes me incapable of remaining awake until tomorrow. And I'm not feeling any pain right now. And that might be okay, but I don't think that's arbitrary. I do think that the opposition to hard drugs, when it was maintained as a moral matter, was in its way good. Now, at the same time, there was an acceptance, for example, of basically day drinking, especially if you were a businessman, it was part of how life was kind of, you know, smoothed along. That, you know, I don't think it's horrible that we don't do so much of that anymore. Although I think, as I would like to talk about a little bit, if we can later, I think that's coming back. But I think that human beings are wired, especially when you're talking about things that food and drink, as well as medicine, are always going to be moral matters, because it's an area of human choice. And when humans make different choices from each other, very, very, very few of us are actually nearly as libertarian, probably, as most of us claim to be, certainly in the modern West. We have all kinds of severe moral judgments about stuff like this. And you can tell because people are willing to evangelize about it.
It's the truth,
like,
man.
You know what I'm saying? Like, people who, if I was like, you know, have you ever at a family gathering, you know, talked about church or Jesus or anything in more than a passing fashion? You know, maybe not. Have you ever, you know, explained what you were eating in exhausting detail? Maybe. You know? And it's kind of like, you know, which one do you need the other person to be deeply interested in? But, you know, discussion of these matters is very easy for people, but it's also a realm of severe moral judgment. And I don't think we can get out of that. Like, you could legalize or you could decriminalize, those are different things, every substance. People would still have severe moral judgments about stuff like this. I don't really think you can get away from that.
Right. And Oregon, it should be noted, Oregon is walking back that legislation like this month, by the way,
right?
After having found out like there needs to be a distinction between, you know, if you want to use hard and soft or whatever,
right?
The idea that there are some substances that if and when they get a hold of you, they destroy you,
right?
And I'm just going to go ahead and say I think processed cane sugar belongs in that category, as does the talking image. And I'm kind of there with modernized wheat, but no one else has to agree with me, but I'm not touching the stuff except for in the Lord's Supper where I have no choice. So there we are. The distinction is important. Also, the distinction that you're kind of dealing with here is the fact that your body and your spirit are not like without communion or something.
Disconnected.
Right? Like, yeah. Right.
Disconnected.
Like what you put in is going to impact how you feel. And this isn't to say you need a better diet for a new you, although, yeah, if you're poisoning yourself, you're going to feel sick. It's how it is. And you mentioned people running into old age a little bit differently than they used to. I'm finding in my age bracket, 40s, mid-40s and 50s, there are people getting old sooner is the way I would say this. And they're predominantly women, but not always.
Yeah. What do you mean?
But they're women who are having hormonal issues and they are immunodeficiency issues and they are coming in younger and younger, so that my children, and I'm going to lay this maybe at some inoculation, you know, hootenanny, my children have some extra immune deficiency results from this. But I do know that part of immune deficiency is inflammation. A lot of deal with inflammation is how your blood sugar is going, and on we go. The fact is that we are hitting a health crisis. I haven't even talked about turbo cancers. We're hitting a health crisis that already feels normalized, and it's not normal. It's so not normal. The normalization is that people in their 40s get sick. It doesn't happen. You die in infancy, or say before age 8 or so, and then you make it until whatever God stops the heart, usually. I guess that's the history of it, right? And now we've got all this other stuff going on while we're pumping ourselves full of, we don't even know. Have you read the side label of a box recently? You know what a seed oil is? You're probably cooking canola still, right? Don't, you know? And again, that's just the nutrition side. But then what I find, Dr. Koontz, is that that was religious talk right there. Like, I'm talking like we need to be healthy about our bodies and not be poisoned. And for someone else, I just really went at like their vegan goddess or something like that, right? And we should see that's bigger than just Christians having trouble with this, but that the vegan movement, the Seventh-day Adventist movement, the anti-cow greenhouse gas movement, these are nutritional crises for the poor that are going to happen as religious movements. How do we ignore that? Body and spirit overlap. I just said a lot, so go wherever you want to go.
For the poor, you can't really afford to have a clean religion, which is why food laws are going to be most strictly obeyed by the affluent of any kind, right? So let's say that you are a very poor Orthodox Jew. You cannot afford all of the separation of meat and milk, or if you live in a country that's not Israel or the United States, where kosher laws are basically part of the food system, you can't afford to make sure that everything was slaughtered the way that, you know, you're supposed to care about. So this, I think you used words from Mark 7. I think Mark 7 is a very powerful way to look at these things, is that when Jesus is talking about that what goes into a man does not defile him, that is especially a preaching of the good news to the poor, because the poor cannot afford, I mean, they in a monetary sense, but also just in a time sense, right? Because part of being poor is that your time is consumed by just trying to make it. So there are luxuries you don't have. Chief of those is time. And being time poor is very different from being money poor. You could be time rich and money poor and live a life that is very satisfying. To lack both, as almost everybody does, that's horrible. So when uncleanliness is then ascribed to a certain set of foods, and I think you're right to diagnose this as religious talk, because you can see the growth of, I don't know, maybe we could call them devotions if they haven't hardened or systematized into religions, or you could call them dogmas that have yet to form into a dogmatic theology. But you see it coming with veganism. You see it coming with the way that people who have changed their eating habits talk to or about people who have not. And it's very much not Paul's approach in 1 Corinthians 9, which is to understand that people are eating whatever they are eating for reasons that may or may not be right at the time. Because when you think about Paul becoming as a Jew to the Jews, that's Paul going back under not the yoke of the law so much as, you know, working with their current delusions that do not impair the gospel, because eating does not commend you to God. I think that the way that has developed among us is, number one, we just ignored that whole section in there in 1 Corinthians had anything to do with life. It was confined to the worship service. So if I don't do a contemporary worship service, or if I do a contemporary worship service, I am, by some reckoning, clean or unclean. But we also took it and we didn't really realize that it's not an accident that the way that you figure out if you really care about somebody is if you will share food with them. And if you will share food with them, then you're going to admit that, you know, this is not the thing defiling them, because you're not going to share sin with them. Right, eating with sinners is not sinning with sinners. Now, the problem here is, you know, there are lots of things that I could be served or have been served. And I think, boy, I really don't. I just don't like this. This is built for a completely different palate. A palate much more interested in mayonnaise than I am.
Check it for soy oil or add it, you know, just check it for soy
yeah.
oil.
Well, yeah, I mean, and I, you know, but it's like,
I get you.
It's what you do. And the reason it's what you do is because when you're talking about these matters of like what you eat, right? So you have to imagine a process occurring in somebody like Paul, but also occurring in his fellow Jews who are converted. Is that gradually they come to realize that the way that they're eating not just like doesn't matter, but actually is in some way wrong or is some big hassle or is some kind of barrier. And then they have to change. That's a process that has to occur in them by and by. And so when you're talking about food and drink, and maybe we can talk more about drugs, when you're talking about food and drink, certainly, you're talking about something where there needs to be some kind of process of thought about it and consideration. And in our, let's say, American default, that's not even how food is marketed to you. Food is marketed to you as a matter of convenience. And anything that is more convenient is going to be better.
Easier.
And anything, and easier. And anything that is less convenient or requires you to like have a home life in order to prepare or something, you know, don't do that, right? And even if you are home, you can just use your phone to get someone else to bring you food. So all of that is, you know, has knock-on effects in the labor required to prepare all that food for you, the labor required by somebody who is willing to try to make a living or part of a living delivering that food to you, like that's all he does. All of that has knock-on effects, basically because food is not a matter of anything that you stop and consider. So, you know, it's not like these things are just separated out in some little separate space where you're like, okay, today we're talking about food. When you're talking about something that you do every day, not only are you talking about a realm of moral judgments, you're also talking about a realm that's going to affect pretty much everything else in your life and maybe even reflect lots of other things in your life.
So let's do a case study on a substance that we have not mentioned yet that I don't think anyone can get too up on because everybody hates these people. And that's smokers, tobacco smokers, right? I mean, we hate these people. They are from the devil. And it doesn't matter if you smoke a pipe or cigar occasionally on your tax form, on your health forms, you're a smoker and you don't belong in our society anymore. You should probably just go die somewhere, smoke some more and die. Right. Smokers, yeah. Don't go to church. There's no place for you there. So anyway, I'm not quite sure that that's what everyone thinks, but I do notice that the smokers at my church don't let anyone know.
Yeah, right.
Don't let anyone know.
Right. Yeah, and it's really funny to me, like Lutherans who are, you know, kind of religiously somewhat frigid, like if I was like, what do you think of when you hear Jesus Christ, you know? They wouldn't tell some like compelling first person story or something, and they don't need to, but I'm just saying they don't. But if you say, well, tell me about when you stopped smoking, they have a compelling story.
Yeah, right. Huh?
In the first person, like emotionally charged, right? Showing that they have emotions. They just don't have them in connection with some topics, but with others, they're quite emotional, and it's intense, and it's a story of overcoming that they would, you know, their pastor would be very reluctant to describe anything as being overcome in a sermon, you know? So there's a completely different way that we talk about this, and it's such a shift. It's an enormous shift because not only was this normal, but you know, nobody really thought anything about it. And there used to be the nice legal fiction. I guess this was kind of like, I guess, removing your mask between bites and then you weren't poisoning people or something. But if you put it back on quickly enough, you know, then then you're not harming them. But the fiction was the smoker section and the non-smoker section.
It's the best. It's
right?
The best.
Because
I remember it. I lived it.
Right. Yeah. I was there. In your average open plan, you know, diner or Pizza Hut, it was a total fiction. I mean, the only time it was ever real was when you had some sort of old fashioned restaurant with plenty of cozy private spaces. And then maybe, you know, you had something like this going on. But the rest of it, I mean, we were all smoking, right? I was smoking at 6, in the sense of everybody's affected by tobacco smoke. It's a good example of something that I think is happening with lots of these other substances that we have mentioned, which is that something goes pretty quickly because of how fast we can get it to you, from having a certain limited place in life to having a potentially unlimited place. And I think that's actually part of the key here, connecting all of these things that we put into ourselves: smoke, eat, drink, whatever other verbs you want to use
consume.
Yeah. Is that one of the things that really defines the past couple hundred years of human existence is that everything is bigger and faster. Communication, transportation, all of that. So we take something that in its original setting in the new world is part of some parts of social life, right? It is particularly important when men gather and discuss things. Okay. In the same way that, you know, certain forms of alcohol are important in social life in the old world. And we take that substance and we start producing it at a scale, both in the old world, Turkish tobacco, and in the new, you know, Virginia Burley tobacco, that no one has really ever done before. And I mean, we did the same thing with fur hats in Canada, you know, so this is just something we do in the modern world. And once that happens, well, now it's potentially available all of the time. And as time goes by, it's less and less and less geographically limited. And we will even invent new forms like the cigarette, right? And then we'll roll the cigarettes for you eventually in time, so that not only can you get more of it, but also when you get it, you can get it in the absolute most convenient form. You don't have to roll it. And when you do smoke it, you don't have to really take any time like you would with a pipe or a cigar to consume it. So there's kind of, I don't really see a way when that's how things work. Cane sugar, tobacco.
Yeah, name it, right?
Furs, anything, right? I don't really see how that can work for a large population to which it's widely available, because the human beings are not themselves changing. They haven't gained since, you know, whatever, 1400, some amazing new moral capacities to have incessant availability and choice and to say no to it. The thing that saved you from severe addiction to a wide variety of substances in the past was just that you'd never heard of them and you couldn't possibly hear of them. You know? So there are these interesting, you know, I think smoking is one of the interesting ones. Cocaine use in the late 19th century, you know, it's right there in Sherlock Holmes, is another example. But these are all examples. It's like, well, if this is going to be available, I can tell you what human beings are going to do with it.
That's right.
Yeah.
Right. That's just it. And the thing is, like, I'm looking at this a little bit from a pastor in Illinois perspective, where, you know, what's available is what's available and it's what's going to be available. And the things that concern me most are the things that are changing the way my people live. Anything that is going to take them further into the industrialization experiment with an abandonment of the distinction between man and woman in their journey through this life as bodies that are to be knit together in families for the sake of the children. Anything that deteriorates that, I think it should stop in that family. If drinking is deteriorating, that it needs to stop in that family. You know, if it's something else, then, you know, we are to mature and become people of self-control. And we have to then distinguish ourselves from the world around us in what we decide to consume and what we decide to pass on. These conversations have to happen in some way or other, in the same vein and at the same time as, you know, you can't be a carnivore at the, you know, the potluck and like sneer at the lady who brought the cookies, right? Like that doesn't work, right? The food is not what's supposed to separate us in the church. So as Christians, in a time where we have to start exercising virtue, morality, discipline, discernment, all these things, we also have to do it under grace because we're kind of in it together and everybody's got their foot stuck in a different jaw at the moment, right? And so, you know, how do we become more wise, repent unto those things which endure? And so much of what you said there, Dr. Kuntz, you know, it's like the dream answer is, well, if we just grow our own stuff, if we all just live locally in a place where it all comes from, we just do what we do. But then, well, that's kind of the shimmer, isn't it? Like a chimera. How do you get there from here? And is that even what you're advocating? I mean, communism in small is not really what you're advocating.
No. I think you have to remember that the reason that Virginia grows tobacco is because they didn't find gold. So it was the replacement, and it was in its own way a much more successful replacement because it didn't have the end date on it that every gold rush does, even when gold is found for gold. So what gets engaged here, I mean, there's, you know, there's the consumer, but there's also the supplier, there's the dealer, right? And what is the motivation of the dealer who may himself not consume any of this? I mean, there have been liquor barons who don't drink, and there have been, you know, Philip Morris executives who did not smoke. And there are certainly drug dealers who don't do the drugs that they're selling to people that are killing them because they know.
I don't think any dealers are doing fentanyl. It just,
yeah, right, right. I mean,
they got to know better.
They're not going to remain dealers, you know, or anything else if they touch the stuff. So the issue here is not just scale. Behind the scale and the incessant drive for greater scale, and that's like a favorite Silicon Valley word, which should make you suspicious. Scale, scalability, scaling. Scaling up is an assumption.
Imbalanced scales.
It's an assumption that, you know, infinite growth is not only possible, it's preferable. And with a certain kind of guru tone of urgency, it's all we can do, right? It's just to grow and grow and grow and grow. So, no, I don't think the solution is going, I mean, because you have to say realistically, well, what is going back to being local? Does that just mean that we all get used to being some version of peasant, and then our bodies can break down in the old-fashioned way? Things can gradually wear out rather than collapsing at one age or another, right? Depending on your,
right.
I think you're right. Depending largely on the food standards in your country, probably Europeans have different health problems than we do. But no, I don't think it's just a scale thing, because the difficulty here is that when people are doing, quote, homesteading, even it, which was done with early tobacco, you know, Virginia was kind of notable for not having any cities to speak of. No cities. Williamsburg was a village, and that was the capital. And there wasn't a whole lot else because the plantations were all self-sufficient in everything except cash, which is what they got from London in exchange for tobacco. You can't really do that without endless amounts of labor. So you can either commit to that for yourself, or, as in the case of Virginia or medieval Europe, you can commit to people living in serfdom, slavery, whatever you legally want to call it, indentured servitude, whatever, however it's legally defined. And if it's
mortgages.
Limited. Yeah, right. Well, What I mean by that is you have to realize that if you're going to commit to certain things, you are also committing to radically changing your life. This is not chickens in your backyard while you still get at least one W-2.
Right.
Very different.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. So this is where, like, we're not going back. And how do we go forward isn't a question we can put on a bullet point list right now and say we know. Other than that, you know, those things which have always endured are to be retained. I don't mean conserving a time of nostalgia. I mean returning to the font, right? Returning to the roots of things. My question remains then, you know, is it possible? Yes, I think so. How do we? That's what I want us all to pray about. How do we separate industrialization from greed? And as Christians, live industrialized, live with electricity, live with running water, live with access to the market of the modern pagans and the food that they want to sell you, and not destroy ourselves. You know, can we not be consumed with the world the way that the world is consumed with the world, while even remaining industrious and loving things that make more efficient things because it can help more of the poor? I mean, that really is how I see it. We live at a time in history where so many things have not been done well that could be done well. Oh my Jesus, like really, do we have time? Can we? But that comes back to the question, you know, can we separate industrialization from greed? Should I use a different term like modernism to refer to this? I think you know what I'm getting at.
I like the term modernity because it captures a capacity for expansion and an expansion of speed and availability and ease that predates the Industrial Revolution, right? In the same way that, you know, the growth of tobacco or the spice trade even before that in the East predate the Industrial Revolution. I don't think you can separate any of this from greed, because if you wanted to be away from greed, you would have to go out of this world.
Yeah, nice.
Right? So that's okay, in a certain sense, in a pragmatic decision-making sense, that's okay, because you can't go out of this world. You can't. And the bare fact is that what I said about scale is this is all just simply a different problem than the problem of the poor you will always have with you, and most mm-hmm. of them will be dead by the time they're five. I mean, part of the reason that we have the health problems that we do is because so many of us are alive. You know, we're not being killed off by things that would have killed us off in previous eras. And, you know, I mean, one way to think about this is there's this little point. This is pre-industrial revolution, but very much modernity. The Hudson Bay Company is way up there in northern Canada. There's a time when they're driven off. It's an English company. They're driven off by the French for a year or two. The Indians, who have quickly become dependent upon them for supplies, for living, and are no longer migrating the way that they had, basically starve over the course of a winter and a spring because of lack of supplies, because the ships are not coming. They were driven off. The French took everything. So what you don't have, it's not like nobody was starving to death ever before that. But you have to realize that if you have a certain set of supplies, a certain set of inputs, then if you don't think carefully about where they're coming from and what they're doing and whether you could, in fact, I think this is probably because of the nature of human appetite, it's probably always best to think, what could I do without, if you have any recognition that there might be too much or it might be fragile or whatever, what could I do without? If you don't ask that soon enough, then you're doing without that, and then maybe you're doing without something that you really can't do without into the bargain, because it all comes from the same source. When you have abundance, you just have a different set of problems than when you have extreme scarcity, extreme scarcity is kind of normal for most humans most of the time for most of history. We have a different problem. And if we don't think about it in terms of what could I do without, or what is gluttony, then, you know, obviously that's going to kill us just in a different way and at a different rate and at a different time of life than scarcity did.
We haven't really talked about, I don't know what to call them, antidepressants, anything that would be used as a pharmaceutical grade you know, classified substance, you're going to have to go to a doctor for this, and yeah. it's going to change the way you think. They operate differently. Valium is not the same as Wellbutrin. So I feel differently about all this stuff. I think everything should be taken as the question of what it is. That said, I think the pharmaceutical approach is dripping with blood, among other things. And in the same corner, and several years into action now, Johns Hopkins pioneering, and I'm not necessarily a fan of Johns Hopkins here, pioneering the use of psilocybin or so-called psychedelic mushrooms in low and moderate dose with counsel to deal with various manners of trauma, psychosocial yeah. issues, and so forth. And here's one of these things where, to me, like, I just think it's really easy to hate on this. It's just really easy to hate on this. And it's a mushroom. It grows out of the ground. Like, it really is just, I don't think we should all go eat it. I'm not saying that, right? Like, but the fact that there's medicine out there saying, hey, maybe we can just like use a little bit of this fungus and like the guy doesn't have to smoke cigarettes anymore. Like, I think that's amazing. You know, I would call that good medicine if it in fact is what it says it is. I don't trust any of this stuff. Thanks to 2020. But that said, you know, it's a nice case study here again.
Yeah. I mean, I don't trust it either, but you have to realize, you know, not you personally, one must realize that whenever you're talking about the pharmaceutical industry, there's always two sides to this. and they're not just the side of, you know, dealer and recipient, buyer.
Right.
Also called patient. The two sides to it are, yeah, there's part of this where demand is ginned up for something that people would previously have simply dealt with in a different way. And maybe in a way that wouldn't make them dependent, medically dependent on painkillers, on whatever it is that they think now, if I don't take this, like I'm not going to get through my life. There's that, right? They can kind of create demand. Obviously, whenever you're selling anything, you can create demand. Wouldn't you be more relaxed if you had some nice Virginia tobacco? Right. You can create demand. On the other side, it is answering something that is there that does have to be dealt with. So there is just complete delusion, but there's something that's there that needs to be dealt with. Example being, maybe you have noticed that the way that hormones are talked about has completely changed. People talk about hormones for one, but that we're all kind of versions at this point, the way we talk about our hormones, of, you know, basically like teenage girls trying to turn into boys. Like, I have the wrong hormones. Please give me the right hormones. These are just varying degrees of the same thing. So the girl wants to turn into a boy, but the, you know, 52-year-old man whose testosterone is going down wants to keep his testosterone up, or the 22-year-old man who for some reason knows his test. I mean, biohacking, to me, part of the creepiness of biohacking is just, why do these people incessantly monitor their own bodies? Like they're all like in the ICU or something, but the testosterone is too low. So now I need to do this and I need to do that. Like we're all patients. Meaning literally sufferers. We're all sufferers and we need to be, you know, we need to have these things alleviated. And that's what all of this is for. I mean, it's one reason that if I were just purely cynical and I were just going to invest, I'd be like, well, who, you know, I know I was told that STEM mattered and the squishiest of the sciences is biology. But because biology and convincing people of things, biologically speaking, because that has to do with the human psyche, here is an absolutely unlimited market. Because if I can convince them that, you know, you could stave off this or that, you could do this if you take this, or if I were selling them a diet regimen or an exercise regimen, beginning with a free ebook. Whatever. That's where the real money lies. That, you know, that's the real gold, because I am selling human beings chances at happiness. And that goes even beyond gluttony. right? That's not just that they want too much of something that may otherwise be a good thing, right? That immoderation is maybe the fundamental vice with food and drink. With pharmaceuticals, I think, you know, we're into an infinitely expandable menu of things that could make everything better.
Yeah, I mean, we have the market of Babylon absolutely exploded into the end of days, right? I don't know if it's really the final last days, you know, Little Caesar and all this, but like I can't imagine something much more crazy without aliens and zombies involved, or a throwback to like, you know, pre-flood times with some sort of grand apocalyptic but not watery event. I don't know. What I am is I'm sitting here in the craziest time I could imagine. I've read everything that I can think of from history, every era. I have a taste of it. You know, and what on earth did we come from, and where are we going? It's not going to slow down. And every single one of us, where we are, therefore has to ask very serious questions about what we consume. And that means, you know, if the light which is in you in darkness is darkness, or the light which is in you is darkness, how great is that darkness, right? Yeah. The eye is the lamp of the body. What goes in your eye? It's not just your eye. It's what goes in your ear. It's not just your ear. It's what goes in your mouth. And all of these things impact who you are as a human being on a daily and on a lifelong or, you know, seasonal basis. And to consume with ignorance whatever the latest whoever, who probably is a pagan, came up with that isn't really food,
yeah,
to sell you this time is ignorance. You're free. But, you know, I think what we're saying is that the church isn't free to just not say to everyone, you're being lied to, you're being poisoned, and you don't have to be. And we can actually be healthy together without necessarily, you know, again, everyone has to figure out their way out of this without creating a Islamic style, you know, Sharia rule set for everybody. Here, do this, don't do that. I mean, the advocacy of going back to actual cleanliness laws would be disastrous for the church, I think.
The common element between prescription that is in error and a complete lack of thought that then leaves you open to whatever it is that is going to consume you after you consume it, drugs, food, whatever, is impatience. Zealots are as impatient as people who are so lazy they give no thought to it. And there's always a time element. There's always the deception in pharmaceuticals, maybe most blatantly, is always a deception about time. So you take, you know, a girl who is 13 and feels weird in her own body, and you tell her that she won't have to feel weird because we'll give her a hormone that makes her, you know, irrationally self-confident like young men are. and it will actually have that effect on her. She will not realize what in just a few years she will regret, in addition to all the other things that go into that hormonal change. But I don't see that as fundamentally different in the temptation that is offered and accepted from someone who is gluttonous. I mean, you are just completely neglecting the time element here of life and how much of life requires patience. And I don't just mean patience with like some horrible situation, like just grin and bear it. That is some element of life. But patience also with seeing the time that it takes for something to work itself out to its natural end, whether that is a girl becoming a woman, whether that is someone's body not having to break down under the weight that has been, you know, packed onto that frame by, you know, the carbohydrates consumed and then, you know, not actually burned up, whatever it is, the common element here is impatience. And I think, you know, that is the reason that is so common is because of the way that our various suppliers or dealers deal with us, because they don't offer us things that are very good for us. They don't offer us things that they themselves maybe even actually consume. You know, there's that quasi-famous idea of, you know, Zuckerberg at the congressional meeting with the tape over his laptop camera or whatever, and, you know, tech executives not letting their kids have phones. You know, so they know things, or they have kinds of patience or awareness that even the people they're selling to do not, and they're willing to exploit that, I suppose. But the common element here is always the lack of patience. And I don't really see why Christians would want to avoid that discussion, because patience is not only part of the fruit, the working, the outworking of the Holy Spirit, as is self-control, but patience also enables you not only to make better decisions, to take a wiser path for yourself, it also gives you patience with other people, right? It's an acceptance of limitation that the dealer doesn't sell you. The dealer never says, please, you know, please only take this amount, and then I want you to stop after a month. If the dealers do, if that's something like your doctor is saying to you, that's probably because your doctor can prescribe you something else that will make him money when he prescribes it. But if the guy is just selling you that one product, whether it's a drug or food or whatever, he doesn't want you to stop. He wants you to be a lifelong consumer. I mean, he kind of needs you to be a lifelong consumer.
Yeah. We all have to take care of the need of the body. And so it's impossible to stop consuming. It's the drive for constant consumption, or the industrialization of consumption, that has been profiteered on, yeah. Or even hastiness is the path of being exploited. And then as we talk about this massive topic today with a wide array of applications, patiently take from it what you can and seek to not be hasty about the changes that you now think, oh, I should think about that. Oh, I should look into this. Okay, well, don't hurry. Go carefully in your way. Trust in your God. Believe on the scriptures. And then, yeah, in Babylon, the Magi aren't telling the truth. They don't put everything on the label. And if you've never thought about those things or looked into them, there's lots of people out there that really do want to help you do that one way or the other, because wisdom does rise, right? It floats. It gets up to the top. And that's Dr. Kunz, you mentioned patience. You know, I'm kind of surprised wisdom isn't more popular with Christians. Like, you would think it would be like all over everything we talk about. And it's just not a word that even gets used much. Yeah, I remember you mentioning a couple of years ago to me how praying for wisdom was one of the best things you ever did. And it resonated with me because I actually had the same experience in the past couple of years.
Yeah.
And so, you know, this is something not only that you just pray for and it falls out of the sky, like it's right there in the book, right? Like Proverbs, just open up, start reading and believe it.
Yeah.
And it will prepare you to cut through some of the noise. You won't even need the footnotes about how this Polycarp, blah, blah, blah. You won't need it because you'll smell where you need to go. And again, you know, you'll know God's leading you where you need to go. It sounds like you want to say something.
Yeah. I mean, I wanted to say that we lack, and this is a cultural deficit of modernity. We lack proverbial wisdom. I cannot tell you how many American adults I know who don't know idiomatic English language proverbs, you know, or Richard's Almanac type of stuff at all. Like, so if I say haste makes waste, you know,
right.
That these are things that are given to you to ponder, and then that you can talk to other people, especially younger people, your children, but younger people generally, with the kind of wisdom that is not, you know, lecturing or berating. Proverbs is so different from the way that so many people fail to relate to each other. I mean, they want to lecture each other. They want to go back over every wrong. They want to whatever. You know, if you have a proverb like haste makes waste, then that makes all kinds of sense of lots of parts of your life. And guess what? You figured it out. So it didn't come as a kind of manacle locked on your wrists that's going to be good for you, you know? This has to do with how people develop morally and spiritually. And I think the reason that Christians are neglecting wisdom is because I don't think we think much about development. I think we think about being right or wrong. So the guy that, you know, 3 months ago wasn't baptized is now a tradcath on Twitter. He's right. Well, you know, he is and he isn't. I'm glad he got baptized. There's a lot of work to do. And if you don't recognize that, of course you will become extremely expert on everyone else's life, as well as prideful, but you also really won't have anything to offer other people. All you can offer them is, you behold in me an example of being extremely right. Well, that's fine if that's the only goal, but the problem is the temptations are many, many, many more than just temptations to be wrong on paper.
What, my son, and what, son of my womb? What, son of my vows? Do not give your strength to women, nor your ways to that which destroys kings. It is not for kings, O Lemuel. It is not for kings to drink wine, nor for princes intoxicating drink, lest they drink and forget the law and pervert the justice of all the afflicted. Give strong drink to him who is perishing, and wine to those who are bitter of heart. Let him drink and forget his poverty, and remember his misery no more. Open your mouth for the speechless, in the cause of all who are appointed to die. Open your mouth, judge righteously, and plead the cause of the poor and needy. You're listening to A Brief History of Power. You know where to find us, or you wouldn't be here.
What do you think of when you hear the word college? Expensive? Liberal? Woke? Imagine a college that is affordable, a college that is unapologetically conservative and Lutheran, a college that won't take a dime of federal funding, a college that teaches the best of our Western heritage, a college where students grow in the Christian faith instead of leaving it behind. This is Luther Classical College, a college by Lutherans and for Lutherans. Visit our website, lutherclassical.org, subscribe, become a patron, and join the thousands who are making Luther Classical College a reality.
North Idaho is home to beautiful mountains and scenic lakes, small-town tranquility, civil freedom, and the faithful Lutheran parish of Blessed Sacrament Lutheran Church, located in Hayden, Idaho, near Coeur d'Alene. Blessed Sacrament Lutheran Church is a proud sponsor of A Brief History of Power. If you like what you hear on Brief History, then you will love Blessed Sacrament, where the Lord's Word is faithfully preached and Christ's body and blood are administered at every divine service. Whether you are visiting Idaho or considering moving to Idaho, wouldn't it be nice? Please join the saints of Blessed Sacrament Lutheran Church for the Mass and Augsburg Academy Bible Study. Directions, service times, and much more information about this confessional liturgical parish may be found at blessedsacramentlutheranchurch.com. Blessed Sacrament Lutheran Church, historic Christian Orthodoxy, the evangelical Lutheran faith in the beautiful inland Northwest. We'll be right back.